Brought to you by Penguin.
Our Hideous Progeny by C.E. McGill. Read by Florence Howard. From the introduction to the 1831 edition of Frankenstein by Mary Shelley. And now, once again, I bid my hideous progeny go forth and prosper. Prologue. "Could you," said the inspector, "run it all by me one more time, Mrs. Sutherland?" I took my time in answering. I paused to smooth out my skirts and steady my breathing to survey the room, its single grimy window, the awful narrow wood panelled walls that gave one the impression of being trapped inside a cabinet. I do not consider myself an expert in lying by any means, but if there is one thing I have learned on the subject over the course of my life, it is this. Lies cannot be rushed. They must be spun evenly and carefully. Too fast, and you risk tangling up the details. Too slow, and it sounds like a stage performance, scripted from the start. And so, despite my racing heart, I paused. "I already laid it all out before the magistrate this afternoon," I said, "and the constable before that, not to mention Mr. Wilkinson, and..." "Yes, well," the inspector squinted at me rather reproachfully through his pince-nez. "A man is dead, Mrs. Sutherland. We must make sure we record every detail. I'm sure you can spare just a few more moments of your time." I looked down at my hands, at the bandages wound around my palms and up my wrists. Four small red crescents bled through the fabric on each hand where my nails had dug in. "Of course, although..." This part I could not bear to take my time over, though I suppose that was all right, as it was not a lie. "Would you make a note, sir, that I plan to go by my maiden name in future, in case you need to find me in London?" The inspector paused, his pen poised above his notebook, and raised an eyebrow. "And what would that be?" "Frankenstein," I replied. "Mary Elizabeth Frankenstein." It was a grey and foggy March day when we brought it to life at last. I'd expected there to be thunder, or at the very least some rain. I had expected that, on such a momentous occasion, nature would have been obliged to provide us with a fitting backdrop. But evidently, nature felt that she owed us no favours, as the morning dawned dull as always, wreathed in a thick mist that dampened clothes and sound alike as it crept over the hills. I took a measure of grim satisfaction in Clark's bedraggled appearance as he let us into the boathouse. He had come to us bright-eyed and brimming with confidence, now in his rumpled shirt sleeves, with grey shadowing his jaw and the skin beneath his eyes, he seemed but a dim reflection of his former self. Henry, meanwhile, outshone us all in his morning coat, the same he had worn on our honeymoon in Lyme, and which had shown the dust of the chalk cliffs so badly. Perhaps he was hoping to make a good first impression. We examined our instruments one final time. The bellows, to provide the breath of life, the stove in the corner to drive the spring chill from the room and to make its cold flesh warm again, the beakers of elixir upon the work table, bubbling merrily on their burners. I measured out a vial and handed it to Clark to administer. Then, having nothing else to do, I leaned in close to the creature and laid a hand gently upon its neck.
"Is it warm enough, Mary?"
Henry asked. I nodded, startled to hear his voice. The room had been so silent before, as still as a church mid-prayer. We had built here, in this half-ruined boathouse on the edge of the Murray Firth, a temple to our own strange gods, to chemistry and anatomy and electricity. There was an acrid smell in the room as the procedure began. The air felt prickly and sharp, bursting with potential, like the moment before lightning strikes. But there was no bang, no flash, no grand transformation. Only something dead one minute and alive the next.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?